This is The Stark Truth, hosted by Robert Stark. Brought to you by StarkTruthRadio.com. Robert Stark is an American journalist and political commentator. You can listen to his podcast at www.StarkTruthRadio.com.
This is Robert Stark. I am joined here with Anatoly Karlin from the UNS Review. Anatoly Karlin, great talking to you again.
Great to see you again.
And I'm also joined here with Konstantin von Hofmeister.
Well, yes, nice talking to you again.
And both of you, you've met up in person in Moscow.
That's right. I think it was about a year ago.
Yep.
Was that via my show, or you discovered each other other ways?
Yeah, I think we were Facebook friends before we met in person. I don't exactly remember, like, how we got in touch with each other. Anatoly, do you remember?
Well, I think you probably saw some of my articles on Russia, on nationalism, I would imagine. And yeah. I was aware that you were living in Moscow since for at least a few years. I don't know how long exactly, but... I think it was, my meeting was national.
Yeah, I think that's it, yes, because I read a lot of your articles, and I was pretty impressed, like, with all the statistics that you presented, all the data. So, like, well-researched articles, and, you know, like, solid arguments, fact-based, not just conjecture, weird theories, you know, very reasonable, very rational. It impressed me, so I think, yeah, that's why I wanted to meet. And as far as I remember, like, yeah, we met, had a couple of beers, had interesting discussions. So, yeah, it was a nice meeting.
Yeah, yeah.
And I've met both of you in person, but in different countries.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, we met in Germany last year.
And Anatoly in Berkeley.
Yep, that's right.
So I will start off with Anatoly's article on the state of the alt-sphere. So Anatoly, you documented the hit counts of various alt-sphere sites ranging from UNS Review to some of the more controversial sites. So, and you, the different kind of political ideologies, you document which ideologies and... genres are growing in popularity. Do you want to comment on that and some of your observations?
Okay, sure. I don't remember the exact details of those articles. I do them approximately twice a year, just to keep an eye on the dominant trends within the so-called alt sphere. There's been some changes. Obviously, the old guard is dying out. The Stormfront is going down on the right or alt right, or however you want to call them. Daily Stormer seems to be going strong despite its very considerable technical issues. Altright.com has pretty much vanished about half a year ago. Once Spencer's outfit had pretty much disbanded. The UNS Review, which is not strictly alt-right, because we also print lots of leftist and alt-left articles.
And you also...
It's going up.
So, yeah, UNS Review is going up, and UNS Review is a big tent site for just general kind of a... So, alt-sphere doesn't mean alt-right, it just means alternative or dissident. So, UNS Review is a sort of big tent for dissident views, and... you also mentioned some left-wing sites, like dissident left, like Mondo Weiss and Counterpunch.
Yeah, yeah, although I don't think there was any particularly sharp or interesting movements there. Well, I mean, UNS Review does have some of those leftist sites, although I think it can be classed as a right-wing site, because for the most part, all the main people there were on the diet. So Donald himself is... is into HPD and has been writing some very, very bold, I'd say, things about Jews in recent months. And Steve Saylor is the guy who pretty much coined the term HPD. I'm a Russian nationalist. Philip Giraldi writes about, criticizes Israel a lot, and writes a lot about the Jewish lobby. So I think these are the more prominent people there. So I think it can reasonably be called a dissident right website.
And it's interesting, but what I like about Un's review is it leans towards a sort of alt-right view, any view that is critical towards Israel, but there's also some counterbalance. So you have Fred Reed, who is has a more positive view of Mexico, and then Alana Mercer has written some pro-Israel articles, so there's a good balance of views.
Sorry, Fred Reed, doesn't he live in Mexico?
Yeah, he does.
Yes.
Right, okay.
Yeah, he's married to a Mexican. And, I don't actually dislike that, although I think he dislikes me. So I think he sort of might be too enthusiastic about Mexico, but he's probably closer to reality in painting it as this middle-income country that's not really a shithole as such, like in the wilder alt-right fantasies, I guess. His Hispanic file views are actually something that he has in common with Don Huns, because as you probably know, Don is actually pretty positive about Hispanics as well. So one of the articles that he's best well known for is makes the argument that Latino crime rate, murder rate, if any rate, don't differ cardinally from white murder rates.
Yeah, on that issue, my views are more nuanced. So, I mean, I'm opposed to just the massive numbers of people coming in, and I also think it's not a good idea to have this large demographic with a separate identity and a strong voting bloc, and just like the sheer numbers that have come in. But at the same time, I think the view that some people on the right wing and the far right have, like those people are all like violent criminals, is not 100% accurate either. So my view on that issue is nuanced. You've lived in a different a working class part of the Bay Area in California, and you've been to London. So how would you compare like the two demographic situations?
Well, if I had to have my population the place that obviously much prefer to be replaced by Latinos, although keeping things the way they are would be even better. And that's my opinion, and I believe that's Don Hunter's opinion as well, and to an extent even Fred Reed's opinion. They're not exactly like fans of mass immigration. And I mean, Don Hunter himself is more of an assimilationist nationalist than that. He one of his big programs was English for the Children, where he was campaigning to get rid of Spanish language education in California and the places with English education to foster integration. So he's got like very classically civic nationalist positions on those issues. But returning to where I've lived, yes, I lived in San Leandro for about a year and a half when I was in the Bay Area. And yes, it's a lower middle class area. I'd characterize it that way. But unlike areas such as Richmond or parts of Oakland, there really doesn't seem to be a lot of crime in San Leandro, and you have parcels left out in front of your house, even though it's 70% Hispanic. The city of Leandro, San Leandro. So those arguments that Latino crime rates don't differ very much from white crime rates, they sort of seem to make sense, actually. So, first of all, you actually have a lot of niqabs. So a niqab isn't a hijab, it's this black sack, and it really stands out. I only saw it about once per year when I was in the Bay Area. To see it in London, you just have to walk out the door. Those Muslim areas, they're not exceptionally criminal either, although there's the whole grooming phenomenon is centered around them, and grooming does seem to be a very mass phenomenon, where Asian grooming gangs, Asians as in Pakistanis, mostly Bangladeshis, Arabs, they groom young people from proletarian young girls from working class families, and rape them. And that seems to occur a lot, but the areas themselves, they're not violent. I think recently London overtook New York as having higher homicide rates, even though the UK has really rigorous gun control.
The Afro-Caribbean or Jamaican areas are actually more dangerous than the Muslim ones?
Yes.
In Moscow, what is the whole situation? Is Moscow becoming dangerous with Central Asian and immigration from places like the Caucasus region?
No, it's not. I mean, to the contrary, Moscow has become a lot safer in the past 10 years, and I mean, it's the improvement since the 1990s has been indescribable. There's no really dangerous areas in Moscow at all, actually. The Central Asian crime rates don't seem to be particularly high. I'd compare them to Latinos actually in the United States. So you do have occasionally Islamic terrorism amongst them, but it doesn't appear to be a mass phenomenon, at least yet. And the Caucasians, the more problematic, especially Chechens, Ingush, Dagestanis. But there's not that many of them.
Did you mention once that some of your ancestry is from that region?
Yes, I'm a quarter Dagestani.
I concur with what Anatoly said. It's 100% true. Like, I've been living here for many years in Moscow, and I've been to pretty much every district. I have friends all over Moscow, and I've never ever felt unsafe walking around either during the day or at night. I don't know, feel pretty much safe everywhere at any time of day. I think what he said though is true though. I would say in terms of crime, I think from what I hear, talking to people, it is also mostly from the Russian Caucasus region, Chechnya and Dagestan, and not so much the Uzbeks from Central Asia or the Tajiks from Tajikistan. Well, I would say Tajiks and Uzbeks, they're non-Russians, so they're immigrants. But I would say Chechens and Dagestanis are not immigrants because they're Russian citizens, because Dagestan and Chechnya are both part of Russia, and they're Russian citizens. So they're not foreigners, so you can't really complain about their presence in Moscow. I mean, a lot of Muscovites, Russian Muscovites, don't like these people, like Chechens or Dagestanis, but they really have no right to complain because they're Russian citizens, and Chechnya is a part of Russia, so what are you going to do? So, I mean, if you complain about Chechens being in Moscow, but at the same time you don't want to let Chechnya go, it's sort of a contradiction here. It doesn't
Well, on the other hand, saying that you want to let Chechnya go can be considered separatism, which is potentially persecutable.
So in the United States, it's politically incorrect to advocate secessionist movements, but you're saying it's actually a criminal offense in Russia.
I mean, you're not going to get prosecuted probably 99 times out of 10 if you just say it. The risk does exist because it's actually this funny thing. I observed it in a few of my articles that if there's a racial chain of privilege in different countries, and some races are more privileged than others. So, for instance, in the United States, the Jews are very privileged. In fact, so privileged that there's talk of criminalizing the BDS, Boycott, Divest, Sanctions movement, which, frankly, I don't really care about. But it's pretty concerning that this is the it's rather telling and ironic that this is the avenue through which the First Amendment is getting attacked. Whereas in Russia, you can say anything you want about, who cares, because there's very few of them here, and you can say a lot of things about Jews actually as well. There was recently a case in which a Holocaust denier got prosecuted, but was not convicted. He was found not guilty of selling a pre-sated. But he was convicted for calling Chechens, Caucasians, cockroaches or something like that. And sometimes it can be pretty ridiculous, actually. There's a Russian nationalist called Konstantin Krylov, and several years ago he said something along the lines of, we should do away with this strange economic model. So he literally said, we should do away with the strange economic model. Those are his exact words. And what he had in mind was the system of federal transfers to the Caucasus. From Russian taxpayers. And it was seen as extremist by the authorities, and he actually had a case launched against him and convicted. And he got a suspended sentence, a big fine, and community service. Although it was later overturned, that conviction, so it wasn't as atrocious as that, but still, it's pretty ridiculous, potentially going to prison for such an anodyne statement as it's time to do away with the strange economic model, which is neither hateful, at least by any normal standard, nor is it really advocacy of separatism.
I know with Putin in the Western media, he's vilified as this fascist, but a lot of Russian nationalists actually don't like him. And one criticism is that he's let in too many immigrants. Would you say it's accurate to describe him as a sort of civic nationalist, like basically in the model of Trump? Like, are there a lot of parallels with Trump?
There's some questions there, which is better, some of which is worse. So he doesn't worship Israel like pretty much all of Russian conservatism does, and cuck for Israel. I'm not one of those people who goes on about Israel and Jews, but I mean, it's obviously pretty ridiculous in the United States. On other things, there are pretty much functionally open borders between Russia and Central Asia. Admittedly, it's rather fortunate, but I don't think that they're settling on mass. So I think it's more of a rotation. They go into Russia, they go earn some money, and then they go back. I still don't think that it's a great model, because this is just money that they're taking out of the Russian economy when could be hiring Russian workers and raising wages instead of suppressing wages. I'm not a fan of this open borders policy with Central Asia, but I don't know if Konstantin would agree, but I'm not actually getting the impression that this mass settlement of Central Asians of the sort that you're getting in much of Western Europe right now.
Well, I don't disagree. I don't necessarily disagree, but you have to understand, like, the arguments that I hear, like my Russian friends and my colleagues at work, the Russians that I'm in touch with here in Moscow, they always tell me, it's like, these Tajiks, these Uzbeks, they do the work that Russians simply won't do, like cleaning the street, cleaning toilets, all that stuff. Russians just won't do it, so we need these people, it's necessary. So basically, like, these Russians are using the same arguments that Americans use in California and all over the place. Like, we need these Mexicans to do all the work that Americans simply won't do anymore. Have you heard this argument from Russians?
Of course. Yeah, I've heard it. Yeah, and and obviously I don't disagree with it. I mean, Russians will do the work if salaries were to be raised. I mean, obviously it would primarily hurt the sorts of people who can hire Tajik or Uzbek workers, but obviously there's a class war element of the sort that you also have in the United States.
So with Putin's economic policies, he's not really a neoliberal, but there are some parallels between Trump's early movement, in the sense that on one hand you have a flat tax, but there's also a nationalization of a lot of industries, so it's sort of a hybrid of conservatism and populism?
No, it's not. It's not, of course. It's a hybrid system. There's neoliberal system. There's some neoliberal elements such as the flat tax, as you mentioned, and monetary policy. And there's some very statist elements, such as if you're talking about big companies, then something like state ownership is around 60%, I think, right now, something along those lines. And many of those state companies are actually pretty badly run, so I'm not actually a fan of this policy.
Is neoliberalism spreading to a lot of Eastern European countries like Poland?
Well, in terms of which neoliberal policies are you speaking of specifically? In economic terms?
In economic. Well, in as far as nationalism goes, a lot of those countries are headed in a more nationalistic direction as far as limiting immigration. And, places like Poland, Hungary, and even Czech Republic are much more anti-immigration than Russia, but it does seem there was a, especially, I'm not sure about now, but in the 90s, after the fall of communism, a lot of those countries embraced Reaganomics, like very low taxes, deregulation on business, privatization.
That's a bit of an exaggeration, actually. So, I mean, I'm not an expert on the Eastern European economies in particular, but I know that Poland actually, was one of the first countries to free up prices, but I mean that was sort of, well, you had to do that anyway, and otherwise there was a lot of the economy remained actually under state ownership well into the 1990s, and this may actually have been a good thing because Russia, the decision to privatize was essentially political. It was to get the big chunks of the economy into the hands of the oligarchs so as to constrain the turn of the Communist Party into power. And obviously the process was very corrupt and inefficient, and actually many of those oligarch-run companies, they were even less efficient than under state management. Poland and Hungary aren't actually like ideal places to do business. I don't think they perform extremely well on the World Bank's ease of business of doing business studies. I think the best performers are the Baltics, especially Estonia. I don't think Poland and Hungary in particular are high on those rankings.
With Western European countries, if you compare the UK and Germany, I get the impression with the UK is all the wealth is concentrated mostly in London and in finance, and England outside of London has been pretty economically decimated, so there's been neoliberal policies going back to Thatcher. As far as Germany goes, I get the impression that they have a much stronger middle class and a more decentralized economy, where you have finance in Frankfurt, and then you have the auto industry and you have a lot of high-end manufacturing. So their economy is, they have a much stronger middle class and a better economic model.
Yeah, that's most, well, I would say that's most certainly true. Yes, it's not, in my opinion, it's not the case in Russia. I think in Russia it's extremely centralized, like from what I know, that it's the same as in Britain. I think in Russia, 90% of the wealth of all the money is in Moscow, basically. So even all the regions, everything is being sent to Moscow. And I've traveled extensively in Russia, and there is a lot of development going on in other cities as well, like other big cities, but not as much as it should be, in my opinion. So, I mean, Moscow region is fairly well developed, but you can go to other cities like, I don't know, Smolensk, Tula, and the surrounding areas, especially the villages and the small towns, and I would say it's rather pitiful sometimes to see the infrastructure in very poor condition, and sometimes I just don't understand, like, why it's not being developed.
and what is the reason? Is it corruption? Is the money being embezzled? Or people, like the government just doesn't care about these other regions? Because right now the population, I think the official population of Moscow is something like 12 million, but I think in reality it's more like 17 million. So it's like more than 10% of the population of Russia lives in Moscow. And I think it's growing.
No, I agree with this. And I mean, it's Russia is extremely centralized. Virtually all the billionaires in Russia live in Moscow. Virtually all the probably half of the science production and cultural events taken in Moscow. And I mean, I wouldn't even say that you include St. Petersburg in that category. I think that St. Petersburg is merely the biggest millionnik, which is the cities with a million people, of which there are about 10 or 12 in Russia. On the other hand, I think the really big difference actually is there's the bigger cities, which might not be as well-developed as Moscow, but they're also becoming really, well, I mean, pretty decent places. I was in Bryansk this summer, where I have relatives, and it's Bryansk isn't exactly the... like the most developed city or the sweepliest city. It's 350,000 people, I think, and probably below the Russian mean median for cities of that category. But still, it would seem pretty well developed, and there were sweeplies in the streets, and there was an Indian vegetarian cafe, which is very sweeply and surprising for a provincial Russian city. That seems to be pretty well developed. But on the other hand, you also have cities like Volokolamsk, which is about 100 kilometers from Moscow, which is much smaller, 15,000 people, and it really is a dump. My impression rather is that the main vector of differentiation is like related to the size of the city or the town. Basically, all the smaller cities, they're being sucked of their human capital.
But I have another question real quick, if you don't mind. So
yeah.
From what I noticed, like, let's talk about salary, for example. Like, the difference in salary between, say, Moscow and the region is grotesque, you know? It's like a person in the same position in Moscow, okay, so say you have like some kind of, say, PA, like personal assistant at a multinational company. They have like a director of a company, you have a PA. PA in Moscow might make, say, 100,000 rubles, which is about, I'd say, what is it now, like $1,500, which is considered a fairly high salary for Russian standards. So this is what they make in Moscow. Say, PA for this company in Moscow makes 100,000 rubles, $1,500. But the same PA for the same company, also maybe for the same director in a provincial city, say, like, I don't know, Orenburg, for example, would probably only make 50,000. Or a person who earns 30,000 in a supermarket in Moscow might only make 15,000 or 12,000. For the same job in a provincial city. I mean, the difference in salaries are huge, the disparity. And in my opinion, then the disparity is not that big in other countries like Britain. Of course, people make more in London, but not that much more. It's not like they make double for the same job than they make in smaller towns like Newcastle or something. But in Russia, that's really the case. That's why everybody wants to move to Moscow, because you simply can't make enough money in the provinces. If you want to make money, you have to be in Moscow, basically.
Well, I mean, in fairness, I don't think it's triple. I think it's double. So, I mean, I was in VDK in Novgorod this summer, and I saw an advert for a job at a local shop, Krasnaya Belaya. I think it's a alcohol shop. And yeah, the entry-level position there was 25,000 rubles. And in Moscow, it might be 40,000 rubles. I don't know. What do you get as an entry-level person at Perekhyostok?
What, like as a cashier?
Yeah. Yeah.
No, I don't think they make 40,000 in Moscow. That's way too much. Oh. It's like 20,000-25,000, I think, a month. Maximum 30, I think.
Anatolia, how would you describe your general economic outlook? Would you say you support a balance between competition to encourage innovation with some government regulation and a social safety net? So you're basically, you say, an economic centrist?
Well, yes. I mean, I don't know if we should have a detailed discussion about this because we have many other topics to cover. But in general, I support some degree of trade protectionism, especially in strategic industries which you want to develop yourself. So, for instance, aircraft manufacturing, and within the country itself, I want a lot of deregulation and a very low amount of regulations, so that there's a lot of competition and less cronyism. Because I mean, the flip side of too much of this is of course you might be like the Latin Americans with their import substitutionism in the 1970s and 80s, where excessive regulations and protectionism just led to favored industries done by cronies settling in and not innovating and becoming very inefficient.
Right. Anatoly, actually I want to go back to what we just discussed before this, like the disparity, the reason for this disparity, because I think it's pretty important, the topic.
Well, I think this disparity is natural because, Moscow isn't just... it's not like it steals resources from the country or whatever. I mean, it's a massive net taxpayer. You simply have the biggest concentration of human capital in the entire country because, it's a legacy of the entire Soviet period. Well, first of all, capitals per se have higher human capital, and secondly, in the Soviet Union, first you had products available in Moscow which were not available in most other cities of the Soviet Union, and everybody wanted to get in even there. But you also had controls, we had the propiska system, and getting it wasn't trivial. So actually getting into Moscow during the Soviet Union, not only did you have to, it was actually a sort of IQ test, actually. It developed this really big concentration of human capital, and consequently it was one of the most successful regions when it transitioned to capitalism. Quickly a lot of high-tech companies set up in Russia with which produced complex products, and so elevated Moscow to even greater dominance over the country as a whole. So I think standard economic explanations apply here. And it's a bad state of affairs. It's not the most efficient state of affairs, and hopefully we'll have some of this human capital that they're fusing to other cities. Although one problem is that Russia has lots of cities with 1 million people, but it doesn't really have any cities with 2 or 3 million people, which seems to be like the magic number you need to really get a diversified high-tech economy going, like you have in say a place like Austin in Texas or the Bay Area or whatever. So this is going to be pretty challenging, obviously.
Anatoly, what are your thoughts on the new political scene called the Alt Center? You kind of fit in with that.
The new political scene, it's pretty old. I mean, the Bay Area guy, and I mean, you sort of identified with that, and I mean, it's been going for a few years now, although it hasn't really made an impact.
I think a lot of people would support it, but for some reason, most people feel like they have to join like the far left or far right. So, I guess a really generic description of the Alt Center is a fusion of dissident right and dissident left views. But there's a lot of different variants to it. So, that's a very generic definition. Anatoly, How would you personally define the alt center?
Well, I mean, it's not my term, so it's a very marginal term. So I'm not sure it's my calling to define it. But in general terms, I agree with how you define that it's people who are not alt-right and SJWs either, and presumably accept HBD and IQ science and think that it's legitimate to apply their insights to national policy, and they generally like against neoconservatism and hardcore intervention. So like somebody like Charles Murray, for instance, his foreign policy views are pretty much neoconservatism, like a lot of the of those conservative boomers of his generation. And I suppose quite a few of them might also be positively inclined towards transhumanism. But I think it's a pretty marginal demographic, to be honest, and I'm not sure that it's going to become very influential anytime soon.
Could you make the case that Ron Unz's campaign for California Senate fits the mold of alt-center because sort of a fusion of conservative views? He ran more as a kind of a civic nationalist, but he's aware of HBD, and he had the free college tuition, and his economic views, some conservative views, some more progressive views, so maybe some libertarian views, so you could say Unz kind of fits that model.
Oh, yeah, sure, but I think he only got something like 4% or something like that, so which sort of confirms my point. So I recently saw an amusing take from Outsiders, that's Nick Land, on Twitter. He was commenting about Bolsonaro and how he had that surprise win in the first round of the Brazilian elections, even though people were comparing him to Hitler. And he remarked that becoming compared to Hitler is fast becoming a necessary prerequisite for success as a conservative candidate.
Anatoly, you wrote about Russia letting in white South African farmers. So this is primarily more for pragmatic reasons that they're an asset rather than altruistic reasons. How does this sort of connect with Russia's historic alliance with the ANC? I mean, this really goes back to the Cold War, because a lot of the whole conflict in South Africa closely aligned with the Cold War.
Well, yeah, sure, but this is ancient history, and I mean, I'm not even sure that the ANC would particularly care about losing troublesome whites to Russia. I mean, what's the big deal? And South Africa isn't an important partner. It's in BRICS, but as one person wisecracked, it's the affirmative action member of BRICS. So it's not that influential anyway. And it's also a propaganda coup of sort, and I think it's something that accepting white South African refugees is also something that the Visegrad countries are considering, because SJWs are dancing about how the Eastern Europeans are racist and don't want refugees. Well, yeah, okay, we'll take in refugees, but do you have an issue with their skin color? Yeah, seems like a pretty good rhetorical approach. I mean, I don't think it's going to become a mass phenomenon because, most of the poor elites, they are the people who are rich enough. They're going to go to places like London and to Britain, to Australia, to the US. I mean, they have the money. And then there's quite a large poor underclass I've seen who basically live in hovels now, and who are like and don't even get to enjoy white privilege, unlike the black South Africans who occupied South Africa actually at the same time as the whites, not really have any better claim to it. I mean, it's the Hoza who are the real owners of South Africa, if you really want to get down to racial justice or whatever. So it's only going to be rich growers who are really attached to the farming lifestyle who are going to Eastern Europe. The underclass won't have the money to go there, and the cosmopolitan boy, the leads, they're going to go to the the Anglo-Saxon areas where they fit in much better with the culture. I don't think it's going to become a mass phenomenon, but it's a good talking point.
There was just an article, several articles on several media outlets a couple of days ago, or maybe a week ago, that the Zulus in South Africa now basically support the white farmers. Or they're thinking about supporting the white farmers because they're saying, like, okay, if we, like, I don't know, expropriate all these farms, then we will basically all starve. So it's not a good idea because we're hurting ourselves and we're the Zulu nation. We don't want to starve. So we're now basically we're now against this expropriation program. Have you read this? It was in Russia Today.
Oh, I read about it, yeah.
Several outlets, yes. So, but I think they've already started the expropriation process. 2 days ago, I read an article, like when the actual process of taking away white property without compensation.
Anatoly, in your South Africa article, you made an interesting point that the neoliberal policies in the West, particularly the United States, make it less desirable for European immigrants or perhaps inaccessible to European refugees in the case of South Africa. So it kind of reminds me as Trump made that comment where he said he didn't want people from shithole countries and that he said he wanted people from Norway. And from the standpoint of a leftist, I can understand how that can be interpreted as a racial preference. But the thing is, America in general is less desirable to immigrants from the first world, and not just Europeans. I would also say that among like the first world parts of Asia, like Japan, Taiwan, Singapore, I mean, those people are much less enthusiastic about moving to the United States than they were 20 years ago?
Well, yeah, of course. I mean, I think in per capita terms, Australia and probably even Canada are more attractive. But I think the Anglo countries do pretty well, though, in attracting high-quality human capital.
As far as European immigrants go, I don't think that Western Europeans are that enthusiastic about coming to the United States, unless they're just wealthy people who are coming here for lower taxes. So basically, the only two groups that would probably be more enthusiastic about going to the United States would be white South Africans or people from the Ukraine.
Oh, well, yeah, of course, although the Ukraine have Poland nearby, which is also very attractive, I mean, relative to the Ukraine. So getting to the U.S. is much harder. But, I mean, I think the critical point, though, and it's a point that many people have made and it still applies to this day, living standards between the working classes in the U.S. And Europe. I mean, the Americans aren't better off the American working class. I mean, they might have slightly higher incomes, but there's also have a bunch of complications to do with healthcare, which eats up any of those advantages, and also higher education is very expensive, and I mean, it's socially expected to get a higher education, even for doing unskilled jobs these days. So, I mean, it all adds up. So, probably the European working class continues to live better than the American working class, but the American upper middle class is much, much better off than the European upper middle class. So, for instance, U.S. doctors, they make approximately three times as much as German doctors. And I do think you have a significant drain of human capital to the U.S. on account of this. So you still have quite a lot of researchers going to the U.S. because, again, American universities, they're better than European universities at this sort of thing. They have more resources there. They perform better in the global rankings. The U.S. Really is really good at attacking those people and for rather legitimate reasons.
And as far as the debate about immigration goes, Trump's talked about merit-based immigration, and there's two ways of thinking. So there's a kind of more cognitive elitist who want to attract the most intelligent, successful people. So that could include a lot of people who are coming in from China and India that you see in the Silicon Valley. And that's the group that would probably benefit the most in large numbers from merit-based immigration. Then if you take a more identitarian outlook, you would say immigrants from Europe or South Africans would be preferable because they're more compatible culturally. Which camp are you more in?
The second camp. I even had an article about this called The Limits of Cognitive Elitism. I think that was the name. And there's basically a bunch of arguments against importing very culturally distinct elite human capital, because first of all, they are probably not going to have the interests of the locals at heart, and they can sort of band together, they can form cliques, and there's all sorts of reasons why it might not be a good idea. However, attacking it from places like Europe seems to be like a very good idea, and attacking it from countries, culturally compatible countries, which are hostile to you, is frankly an excellent idea. So, for instance, I think that hoovering up human capital from Canada would be a nice thing for Trump to do as a deliberate policy. So that's calling out my commenter at my blog called Tolfinson, who wants to annex Canada, and he's very based, and I think that crippling Canada in such a way would be a good first step.
That's interesting, the concept of a brain drain, because there's a lot of people who are anti-immigration. There is this, I was listening to some guy who's an Iranian nationalist, and he actually said he supported Trump's travel ban because immigration has acted as a brain drain, and it's actually weakened Iran because their most their best scientists and most educated people have immigrated to the West.
Oh yeah, of course, and as a Russian nationalist, I'm actually quite happy that we don't have a association agreement with the EU, because the Poles, not so much the Czechs, but the Poles, the Ukrainians, they've lost lots of people, especially quality people, to the EU, and so it's not a good thing to happen. But I think that it's definitely something that could be weaponized against some countries in particular instances. So, for instance, this is what China is currently doing to Taiwan. Specifically pay Taiwanese professors higher salaries, and plenty of them have migrated to China, and they also buy out entire Taiwanese companies and relocate them to Shanghai. So this first helps cripple Taiwan, and which is a hostile renegade state, basically, and that rightfully belongs to China and needs to be put out of its misery as soon as possible. But this seems like a very good first step to do that, and it seems to be very successful. So China has benefited from this, and Taiwan's elite scientific output, as proxied by the Nature Index, has fallen by 40% in the past 5 years alone. Which is the biggest collapse of any major country. The Taiwanese, they're obviously not going to cause any problems within China, and to the contrary, it's going to create a positive effect both for China and in terms of Chinese geopolitical interests. So this is why it's a very good idea, and I hope that Russia starts to implement something similar with respect to the Ukraine and to Belarus sooner rather than later.
Let me ask Anatoly a question real quick. Anatoly, I read an article that you wrote a couple of weeks ago in which you said that sooner or later a lot of, native Europeans will get sick of multiculturalism in, say, Western Europe. They will get sick of the influx on Africa and Arabs from the Middle East and all these so-called refugees and migrants, and the rise in crime, they won't like it, the daily rapes and the daily killings, they won't like it, you know. But they're hipsters, you know, because you have these young hipsters, you know, they like their coffee lattes, they like their movies with subtitles, all that stuff, like these real, like, masculine barbershops, you know, like beards with short hair, all that stuff, you know, you have these guys, yeah. You know, they're very progressive, but they don't want to deal with all the migrant crime. So I think in your article you said that there's a distinct possibility that a sizable portion of these people will look elsewhere to live, and Moscow could be one of the destinations. And I think in the article you wrote that Moscow is already like sort of like getting prepared for these people, because you have all these like cool cafes, you know, like also hip barbershops, restaurants, etc. and so on. So what do you have to say about this?
I don't really recall having that in an article about this. I think it was a comment, and I think it was Aquarius Anon who left that comment, actually.
There is this article Anatoly wrote recently, let me see, titled, I think it's Merkel's Plan, and it's about a Germans, mostly retirees, moving to Hungary.
Yeah, about to Hungary, yeah. So there's 30,000 of them or something like that. So, yeah, if they're going to move, they're obviously going to move primarily to Visegrad countries, because they're much closer. And, Moscow is more of an exotic destination, and there's lots of visa issues, and you can't actually get Russian citizenship without declining your previous citizenships. So it's I'll admit that Russia isn't actually the optimal immigration destination for top tier human capital. I actually support making some of the procedures easier. I don't see it becoming a really significant mecca for West European refugees, tired of refugees welcome and all that crap anytime soon.
Yeah, it's kind of hard to say. I mean, looking at the future, right now I don't think Western Europeans would want to move to Russia, but who knows what could happen in 20 years. I'll just sort of comment on the whole theme of immigration and cognitive elitism. So if you look at the Silicon Valley, you have a lot of successful Asians and Indians in the tech industry, and you could say from an economic standpoint those groups pay a lot into taxes and they're economically productive. But then there's this issue of these large blocks, these large areas where white Americans are just kind of excluded economically and demographically. And you have a massive white flight out of the Bay Area, so I mean there's kind of that issue. But if you say hypothetically, the white elite from South Africa, or if you have a lot of German doctors who were to come here for higher wages, those groups would just sort of assimilate into the general white population. So it's not so much just about like IQ and income, but about which groups are most compatible with the people of the nation. So you have to take that into account. And I don't really think if Trump were to implement merit-based immigration, it would be more focused on what's in the best needs of corporate interest or the tech industry, rather than what immigrants are the most compatible. So ideally, you want to choose those groups that are the most compatible.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's like that meme, why not both? I would probably support a return of those national quotas, which you had in the golden age of American immigration restriction after World War I, and coupled with special preferences for the high-quality sorts of immigrants from those places. And I think that would be a very competitive approach to take.
What's interesting is the blogger J-Man. He's an HBD blogger, and he's actually of Jamaican... He's from Jamaica, or of Jamaican descent. But he put out this post of actually a merit-based point system where you grant points to countries that are most compatible. So, I think first he put, like, Western Europe and the Anglosphere, then Eastern Europe, then the first world parts of Asia, then maybe China and Latin America. And then I think he put, like, Africa and the Muslim countries further down. So, I mean, that would not be, I don't know if that would be practical to implement politically, but if you were to have merit-based immigration, it would make sense to have something like that where a point system based on which countries that are the most compatible culturally. Because there's not so much the left is going to say, oh, that's supremacism, but it's really about, like, what people are most likely, like, how well are they going to integrate with the local population?
Well, I mean, one of the benefits of Trump is that he's been, like, whatever criticisms of him. And, I mean, I think overall, a lot of people have been relatively disappointed with his performance. But I think the one undeniable good thing he's done is he's shifted the Overton window quite a lot to the right, and things that were, like, unimaginable are now, like... If not entirely feasible, then at least people are ready to discuss it. Who knows? Maybe we'll get such a system eventually. Yeah, there's going to be some elections now. Elections coming up, and in 2020, I'm pretty skeptical about Trump's chances, to be frank, because it will be in the depth of a recession. By then, so I know that like incumbent presidents have a pretty big advantage, but it will probably be in the middle of the session by then. On the other hand, if the Democrats really go haywire in the 2020s, then there could be an even stronger reaction from the hard right after that, and maybe mid 2020s we'll see something like that.
I think Trump's a mixed bag. I mean, he does a lot of good things. Like, the best thing is that he triggers the leftists a lot, and leftists get really pissed off, which is really funny. I think that's the best part. And what he just said, he said, "I'm a nationalist." I think you probably also read this at a campaign rally in Texas. He actually said, nationalism has a bad rep, but, you know, basically, I'm a nationalist. You know, but we know he's a nationalist, but he's a civic nationalist, you know, so his definition of nation differs from mine. So for him, it's like a proposition nation, you know, it's like anybody can become American, you just have to believe in the ideals of America, the freedom, democracy, all that stuff, you know, and then you can become a good citizen, it doesn't matter where you come from. I think that's his idea of nationalism, which is fine, which is civic nationalism. And Trump does good things. I mean, he's now, he's like railing against like the so-called, like, what is it, like the refugee caravan from Honduras, which is now Mexico, soon coming to the US. And I think what he's going to do is going to tell us a lot about Trump's future, because I think they'll probably reach the border in the next couple of days. The question is, what is he going to do? Is he going to cave? Is he going to let them in? Is he going to let some of them in? Or is he going to let none of them in? I think that's a very decisive factor, because if he lets them in, it will never end. Like, you'll have thousands, hundreds of thousands, eventually millions. You know, everybody will come to the US because it will be like an open invitation, basically. If he doesn't let them in, I think he'll be reelected in 2020.
I mean, I feel the same way about Trump as Anatoly. So in a lot of ways, I'm extremely disappointed. I mean, for the most part, he's been... a lot of his comments, like on nationalism, are good, but most of his policies have been standard mainstream Republican policies. But the problem the Democrats have become so militant on this open borders issue, far more so than they were in the past, even under Obama. So if the Democrats take power, they're going to aggressively push open borders as much as possible. So that's just the situation that we're in.
You know, it's just a matter of time anyway. I think it's all hopeless anyway, because I'm pretty much a black pillar, and so I took the black pills.
For the United States or the entire world or Western civilization?
Well, the entire Western civilization is a matter of time, you know, because in Europe you have all of Africa coming, and in the United States you have all of Central and South America coming, and it's only a matter of time. Like, even if Trump sends the National Guard to the border, even if Trump won't let them in, it won't make any difference, because, okay, even if he gets reelected and he'll do it again for the next, I don't know, 6 years. Eventually, you'll have a Democrat president, and he'll open up everything anyway, and they'll all come in. So eventually, America is going to be flooded with these people anyway. It'll happen. There's nothing you can do about it. And it's the same in Europe. It's just pure mathematics, you know.
Here's a white pill in the answer to that black pill. So even if, like, all the borders vanish and there's, like, a melange of different peoples, fertility preferences are heritable, like all personality traits, and the demographic transition happened in the countries of Europe and America about 1 to 2 centuries in advance of most of the rest of the world, especially the Muslim world and the Africa. Africa's demographic transition is only starting. So you'll have you already have strong selection for so-called breeders, people who want to have more children, and this might, in the coming dysgenic centuries to come, reverse the current expansion of the tides of color, and whites might start to rise again as a percentage of the global population.
You have these religious sects in the United States, like Mormons, Amish, and Orthodox Jews.
I mean, they're the extreme examples. Already in the midst of this transition, but there's no reason why this shouldn't apply to wider society as a whole. It's just lagging by a century or so.
But the thing is, those groups are too small to make an impact on the overall demographics of the West.
But I'm not talking about those groups. I'm talking about those same trends, those same selective pressures. They are happening amongst ordinary Americans as well. So here's a fascinating fact. The highest fertility rate currently amongst the natives of any white country are currently in France now. And there's a startling coincidence that France was also the very first country to have the demographic transition. So fertility rates amongst the French aristocracy collapsed as early as the 17th century and spread to society at large by the beginning of the 19th century. Do you like my futurist white pill in response to your more immediate black pill?
No. I do like it, you know, because I like the contrast. You know, I'm not saying I'm right. It's just what I feel, you know. Like, I hope that I'm wrong, and I would like to believe you.
Yeah. I mean, I'm actually not just making things up. There was actually a recent study released by some evolutionary psychologists, and they modeled the population of the world, assuming that selection pressure for fertility preferences exist. And the general picture follows the UN projections until 2050, approximately, and then they start to diverge quite a bit. So they have European fertility approaching around 2.5 children per woman by the end of this century.
So that was interesting about France, because I've seen those statistics, but my assumption was that it was more because of immigration.
No, I mean, immigration would lower the French fertility rate by 0.1 children, although it would lower lots of other countries as well. The French natives would still remain ahead of everybody else.
So you're talking about more like the traditional Catholic types?
I mean, France was the first country to see the demographic transition, so plummeting fertility rates, and then so I mean this is one of the big puzzles of history, why France was the first country to undergo that, even though it was the Anglos, the Great Britain, which had the first industrial revolution. So why this contrast? So I don't think anybody really knows, but still we have this historical pattern, and now it emerges that France is the most demographically vigorous country in the past decade, and it's had pretty good demographics since World War II, actually. So there seems to be something to that.
And I read that book a while back, Pat Buchanan's Death of the West. He blames the demographic declines primarily on social liberalism, and a lot of right-wingers advocate more right-wing economics. But ironically, it's actually the more progressive countries even Scandinavia that have healthier birth rates compared to the more religious countries like Italy and Greece and parts of Eastern Europe. I think a lot of it has to do with like generous maternity benefits, a lot of the stuff that the left advocates.
Oh yeah, sure. And I mean, our problem in Europe, in Eastern Europe and the Mediterranean, which is actually no less than the immigration problem, which sort of slightly exaggerates birth rates in like France, Germany, and so on. Eastern Europe and Mediterranean fertility rates, they are depressed by the fact that many young people they also migrate actually to France, to Germany, and so on. This, you especially see this in with respect to Poland, for instance. And so yeah, this is a problem that the countries which have adopted open borders with the EU suffer from.
Another trend I've heard about is I think it's called the horseshoe theory in fertility, is that the birth rates are high in both the upper class and the underclass, but they're declining the most in the middle, which actually makes sense considering the middle is where the biggest economic decline has been.
I haven't. I'm not sure that it's correct, but I mean, I think the economic decline in the United States at any rate has been not in the middle class as such, but in the amongst the white proletariat, which is partially why they voted for, they deserted the Democrats for Trump. And in France you had, I think, similar things. You had them deserting for the National Front from the communists. And now you see this in Germany as well, leaving the Social Democrats and migrating to the AfD.
I would like to thank Anatoly Karlin and Konstantin von Hofmeister for being on. It's been an excellent show.
Well, thank you very much for having me again. I greatly appreciate it, as usual.
Uh-huh, and yes, thank you for the invitation. It was a pleasure, as always.